Hi, I'm magician Nelson Lugo.
Hi, I'm nerdcore rapper Shafa the Dark Lord.
We're best friends
who hate each other's guts.
And we co-host the Epic Podcast,
a monthly show in which we discuss comic books,
video games,
television,
movies,
our debilitating emotional problems,
and Batman.
So much Batman.
That's the Epic Podcast
on the Nerdy Show Podcast Network.
Be safe, internets.
Bye. Seriously, so much Batman.
Flame On is presented by the Nerdy Show Network, geeky programming for all nerds across the multiverse. All Nerdy Show programming is made possible by A Comic Shop, Orlando's number one comic shop and nerd destination, and with the generous support of listeners like you. To learn how you can support this and other fine geeky programming, visit nerdyshow.com.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Flame On. I am Pat, your talking bearskin rug, and we have an extra special treat for you for our microsode this month. Actually, our second of this month, because August has extra weeks in it that some of the other months don't have. You get two microsodes this month. I am being joined by our first time co-host. He has been name dropped by me on our other episodes before. But he is now getting to actually be on the show and is helping me with this very special interview. We have Jay Abbott joining us as a co-host. What's going on, Jay?
Hey, I'm happy to be here.
Very nice. Very and Jay is another Florida geek. He is in South Florida. So when this interview came around, I felt a connection to the material and that Jay was the proper person to ask to bring on to this interview because our very special guest is Scott Lobdell, writer of many, many things, including a lot of extremely big X-Men stories in the 90s, Generation X, and Happy Death Day. Scott Lobdell, how are you doing?
How's it going?
Let's go back to the beginning. What got you into writing comic books?
A lot of guys like Wade and Busick and those guys can tell you what Superman had for lunch in Action 23 or something. And I was never that guy. When I got into comic books, I got into comic books because I was in the hospital a lot when I was in high school. I had my lung kept collapsing. And everybody would bring me comic books to read because I was too young for, I guess, Playboys and stuff. So they bought comic books. And the very, very, very first time I read a comic book, I was like, you know, my reaction wasn't like, oh, this is a strange world. It was, wow, somebody's got to do this for, what is this? Okay, there's words, there's pencils and inks, and wow, somebody has to do it. So my whole initiation in comics was, this seems like the coolest job in the entire world, you know, to be able to tell stories. And I went on to go to college for psychology. And one day I was like, you know, everybody in the world has a problem and I don't want to listen to everybody's problems forever. So I was like, bad attitude for psychologists. So then I was, light of psychology is, conflict resolution. So I was like, well, comic books are, I mean, every story has to introduce a conflict and have to resolve it. So I started pursuing that. And it's funny because even when I very, very, very first started, I was like, you know, I'm going to do comic books for 3 years and I'm going to do like, you know, TV and movies. And at the time it was kind of an absurd thought because there weren't really a lot of, movement back and forth between the industries, but now it seems, you know, like you need a TV show first to get a comic book. Now it seems like for some companies. you know, like I look at like a Guggenheim and stuff. I mean, he's great. I love Mark. And, but it's like, you know, him bouncing from, you know, TV to comic, comics to TV. I wish I could do that. So I'm envious of him. But I mean, that's like, we see a lot of that. But at the time, it was kind of a fanciful idea on my part to use comic books to break into movies. Here I am.
Awesome. How did you end up on the X titles when you went to when you were with Marvel?
Well, I've been writing for about 3 years on Marvel Comics Presents, and what happened was I tried to break in for about 6 years. I got a entire wall of rejection letters, and I had a bunch of rejection letters. So I Marvel Comics Presents started, and they were doing these 8-page stories, and I found out that the editor was a terrible, terrible job for the editor because he had to get approval for an 8-page Daredevil story or an 8-page Wolverine story or an 8-page Captain America story. But because they were only 8 pages, he couldn't really do anything interesting with them. So he would get the writer to write it, and then they'd give it to the editor, and the editor would be like, ugh, why? Oh, Daredevil, what is it? What is, you know, like, it's not about anything. In Captain America, like they were torn between not being able to write stories that were about anything or trying to write stories that were about something that would get nixed because it had to be something that took place in, you know, you couldn't do an issue where Captain America's shield melted because then they'd be like, well, you can't go back to Captain America and be like, here's your character back, but no shield. And so, I was looked at it and I'm like, huh. So there was something out called Contest of the Champions where it was, superheroes from all over the world. So I went to the editor and I'm like, how about if I do the Global Village series? He's like, what's the Global Village series? And I said, well, you know, it would be a bunch of standalones with, Shamrock and American Eagle and Arabian Knight and any other character that no editor wants to touch because no one was going to be, hey, Shamrock's my character. And so I did that. But what that allowed me to do was I was able to write these, like, really, in some cases, pretty deep stories about these characters so that by the time you read the 8 pages, you're like, oh, my God, I never thought that that crappy Shamrock character had such a sad origin. And, you know, and I remember one time I did a Lockjaw story and I walked around the offices. Anytime I got any gig at all, I walk around and go, hey, got the Lockjaw story. And we'll be like, wow, you must have really wrestled for that one. And so, but the thing is, I took it and I set Lockjaw at this story at a Babylon fire and how he went and he saved the fireman. It's a really sweet story. And so I was walking down the halls one day and the editor, Ralph Macchio, came up and he's like, I gotta tell you, Scott, I can't believe I'm saying this, but that was the best Lockjaw story I ever read. And in my head, I'm thinking, well, that was the only Lockjaw story you ever read. Okay. And so what that did was it allowed me the sheer volume of work that showed, you know, that I could do comedy, I could do sad, I could do scary, I could do. So when Chris left the X-Men and John Byrne put his foot down that he wanted 2 weeks of 2 weeks with each script, it put the editor in chief in a bind because the books at the time were being done by Wills and Jim Lee in San Diego. And they would, you guys don't remember this. They used to have these things called faxes. they would, the, what happened was this Christmas, is the night of the Christmas party and Bob Harris, who I'd only spoken to once before in my life.
Oh.
We'd gotten in a fight over, the Beast. And, you know, my friend was like, you shouldn't piss off Bob Harris because he's the X-Men editor. And I was like, the likelihood of me ever writing the X-Men is so infinitesimally slim that I think I'm okay, you know. And so only the second time he talked to me, he came into the editor's office, and I was there doing work late that night, and because it was the night of the X-Men, I'm sorry, night of the Christmas party. And he comes in and goes, Scott, walk with me. I'm like, okay. So I walk the whole length of the offices, and we get in the room, and he goes behind his desk, and he pulls out 22 pages of faxes, and he goes, 22 pages in 24 hours, can you do it? And I was like, yes. And in my head, I'm thinking, well, if it's terrible, everybody's going to go, well, you know, we only had 24 hours. And if it was good, people were going to go, holy shit, look what he did in 24 hours. And it turned out to be really good. But what I didn't know at the time is that he, when I looked at the faxes, there were about 10 finished pages. And then there were like circles with an R and an X with a W, which meant Rogue is standing here and Wolverine is standing here. And there was no plot. There was this story. And this went on for about 4 months. And I would get these faxes with 2 weeks to go before I had to be at the printer. And at the time, the book was selling, you know, almost nearly a million copies. So you couldn't, it's not like it is today where it seems they start a series and then it fizzles out and you never see, or, you know, like it gets delayed a month and then 2 months and 6 months. And then you're like, whatever happened to that series? With this, it was, you couldn't even move from one quarter to the other quarter. You couldn't miss a month, because if you missed a month, it meant, you know, millions of dollars for the company. So, you know, they couldn't, so that's how it was done. I would get these faxes and they would have a vague idea what the story is and they would send it to me. Okay, here it goes. And, but the thing too is I had been a stand-up comedian for 5 years at that point. And the thing about stand-up comedy is you don't get to, be doing your routine and then be like, you know what? You know that joke that I told 5 months ago? I'm going to try that again and see if, like, you know, you just have to, you know, you just got to do what you do and trust what you're doing on stage. And that's what happened with the X-Men. It was like, I didn't have any, you know, people would say to me, like, were you nervous about taking it? I had no time to be nervous. I only had time to do the job. So, and then after 6 months, it was decided that Fabian would get, they had promised Fabe the X-Men book. And at that point, they said, well, Fabe, you can do X-Men and Palestine Uncanny.
That's fantastic.
I gotta say, it was funny because people would always be like I said about the argument with Bob, my goal into getting into comic books was I wanted to be the next X-Men. Like, the X-Men was number one. And I'm like, I'm going to knock the X-Men off its pedestal. I'm going to be the next number one. And the first series I got was Alpha Flight. And I was like, you know what? I when X-Men started, it was bi-monthly. You know, and people aren't really paying that much attention to Alpha Flight. I can do this. I can make Alpha Flight big. And so when I got the X-Men, it was a surprise because it had never, you know, I mean, I, you know, have a pretty good imagination and I can picture winning an Emmy someday, but I would never have ever imagined that I'd be writing the X-Men for, you know, even one issue, let alone 7 years. So, pretty crazy.
That's incredible. So you are responsible for many of the storylines with the X-Men that formed not just mine, but obviously Jay's childhood or adolescence. And I know, Jay, there's a particular storyline that impacted you immensely. And I think you had some comments and questions about that you wanted to jump into.
I have honestly, I have so many questions. I'm a kid that grew up on the X-Men. I started reading in the middle of the Executioner storyline while you were in charge, which is probably not the best place to jump in. So I like instantly started grabbing back issues. I really wasn't into superhero comics at that point. The X-Men was my doorway into that, if you can even call them superheroes. They're more or less, you know, marginalized minorities. But I loved your approach to them, the way you kind of kept them very grounded. But what I think Patrick is talking about, and I've often joked about this on my Facebook, is that there was one particular issue of the Uncanny X-Men that traumatized me as a kid.
Oh, okay.
And it was issue 303, which is, for people who aren't familiar, that's the issue where Ileana Rasputin dies of the Legacy Virus.
Uh-huh.
And for people who don't know, Legacy Virus is basically an allegory for the HIV/AIDS crisis. And it was a storyline about this little girl who contracted the virus, and they tried everything to keep her alive. And it's just so depressing, but so brilliantly written. Still, when I talk to people about my favorite comics of all time, that's usually one of the ones I go to still to this day. And I know other people say that too, that they love that issue. It's one of their favorites. Kudos on that.
Thank you. You know what it is? It's funny. I really, there have been a few times when I think I've gotten people to like tear up at a comic book.
Yeah.
I know in about two months, Red Hood number 27 is going to come out, and that's going to be like a bawling experience. But that was a very sad issue. But it's also like, if you chart my, X-Men run, there are a bunch of issues that would like they'd have the big event.
Yeah.
And people would get angry, oh, big event, and they would get really angry. But then I was like, you know what? After all the big events, I always had that kind of like slow down just character story. And I remember one time around the time Scott and Jean got engaged, his name is Ski. He's over at DC now, but he was at Marvel at the time. He's a marketing guy. He comes down and goes, I gotta say, Scott hasn't thrown a punch in the X-Men in 4 issues. Like, no one's used their powers. They haven't gotten any fights. And Bob's like, oh, you know, we can change that. He goes, no, but oddly, I dig it. I kind of. So, you know, I mean, I certainly can do action adventure, but I do like the stories that just slow down to a crawl and just really deal with the people, you know.
Well, that's a huge, like, that was always huge with the X-Men, was that, especially for me, well, and speaking for myself, that the character-driven plots for this team of misfits, and it was always that thing that really struck home for me, and that was what kept me reading. I got into it, I think, in 91. I think it was with Jim Lee's X-Men number one was around the time that I got into X-Men in general, and then started kind of like Jay did, going and grabbing back issues and finding all these stories. And it just, seeing like Executioner Song, seeing Age of Apocalypse, seeing the entire Legacy Virus come to fruition and start to ravage the team, and it was always those relationships and those really character driven plots that were huge for me. Like, the action is always good when you've got these big battles and you've got these big grandiose events, it's fantastic. But seeing how that team, who isn't family, was still family, was huge for me, and it shaped a lot of my growing up, and that's something that I still carry to this day with me.
Well, you know what's interesting is that at the end of towards the end of my time at Marvel, we were doing this Heroes Return, and they were trying to bring in other divisions instead of like just the X-Men. We were trying to make events that were specific to all of the universe. And we were sitting around, and they were like saying, okay, well, for the return of the heroes, it'll be cool if Franklin has to decide between saving the universe or saving his family, you know, and that'll be cool. Like, save the alternate reality or save his family. And I go, you know, I don't know, honestly, like, the whole point of Marvel has always been, you know, like, the world outside your window, as they say. And, you know, like, to me, like, Age of Apocalypse, yes, it was a giant world, but that whole world was predicated on one simple concept. What would the world be like without Charles Xavier? You know, and the idea that everybody who has been an X-Men or even an enemy of the X-Men was impacted as a result of that is what made Age of Apocalypse, you know, aside from the costumes that looked awesome and this, you know, the different roles characters played, it was because it was so simple. It was all predicated on Charles not being there. The notion that a kid has to choose between his parents and the universe was like, we have gotten so far off track of what makes a personal story a bigger story or a bigger story a personal story. And, you know, I look at a lot of events and I see events that are like, you know, I see a lot of events that have nothing to do with character anymore. They're like plot events, like, you know, I don't want to shit on anybody's story, so I can't really say per se, but I do think the reason why, I don't find them as, appealing as they were. I don't know, I'll say this, like, you can look at a comic book from 30, 20 years ago and be like, oh my God, that was, you know, amazing. I felt it and I still feel it. I don't see a lot of that in comic books these days, you know?
Yeah, I definitely agree on that. Actually, one of the things I love about your run, you touched on it, is after the big events, like I remember specifically the Flanks Covenant, if I'm saying that right. But right after that, they dealt with the whole idea of the school being demolished, Jubilee and the other kids having to go to the Massachusetts Academy. And those stories were great. And there really wasn't a lot of fighting or action in them. There was a lot of character things. I still remember the first issue after the Flanks Covenant, Jubilee and Archangel, who never really talked that much, had this like great moment. And I absolutely love that. I really kind of wish Marvel would go back to that type of storytelling. Right now, I feel like they're going from one big major crossover event to another one, and there's really no in between. There's not a lot of, they keep on running in circles with character development. And that's one of the things I loved about your run, was that you were really progressing the characters and moving them forward. You established Jean Grey and Scott's relationship further from what Chris Claremont had done in X-Factor, and progressed Jubilee into being closer to a mature adult. I don't want to say a mature adult.
Well, you didn't. I mean, Jubilee was just like,
oh yeah,
what she was. And then with that issue, you're like, oh okay, I get it. She's not Kitty. She's her own thing. You know, she was always kind of like this, you know, strange knockoff of Kitty. But like,
right,
together in the same panel, you're like, oh, totally different characters. So, but you know, what's funny too is like, I don't know, like towards the end of my run, when I was doing Extinction Agenda and stuff. I like, to me, it was very clear. Like, what I wanted to do, I always wanted to move the X-Men forward because, like, you know, you guys read it at a certain time. I read it at a certain time. My favorite X-Men was always, from like 96 to 105, you know, with, you know, Thunderbird's brief appearance, Banshee, Colossus, Nightcrawler, you know, Storm. But it was, you know, the first time Wolverine used his claws to, you know, when he was using the claws to like carve his initials and table at Xavier's and stuff. Like, you know, like that group was my favorite. But I know that other people, their favorite was when they were in Australia, or their favorite was when, you know, they weren't even interesting until Gambit came along. To some people, you know, like everybody has their own favorite run, And I think that was speaking to Chris's genius. He really did. He was not afraid to change up that lineup and move people in and out. And so I was trying to move people in and out. And really, what I was getting was one more pushback about, you know, I mean, you'll notice that as soon as I left, the instant that I left, it was Kitty, Colossus, and Nightcrawler back in the book. And I was like, boring. Like, you know, yeah, they were a favorite run of mine, but like, I want to see progression, you know. And now I look at the books and it's like, you know, I mean, I can't say because I'm only a casual glancer. I haven't read an X-Men book in years. But since Josh brought back Colossus, because I was curious. But like you say, Archangel and Jubilee having a conversation, like that's interesting. You know, all of a sudden you're like, you know, or Forge leaving Rogue, I'm sorry, Forge leaving Storm. In that first issue, when I finally got a chance to start writing it, they had said, what do you want to do? And I said, well, you know, there's way too many characters. And I don't understand, like, all I ever hear about is, you know, Rogue and Storm and their love and the finest, da, da, da. And I went back and said, they haven't spoken in 4 years, as near as I can tell. I mean, like, I don't know how they're the greatest love of each other's lives. You know, maybe it's all happening off panel, but I don't see it. And so, so I felt that there was a lot of, I just feel there's so much to be done with the dynamics of mixing characters. And a lot of times I'll look and I'll see where, it seems like they have a plot, and what they need in the plot is for this character to act this way. And so that character is acting this way so that they can deal with this character's acting. And it's like, okay, that's a plot, but that's not a character. That's, you know, making your characters bend to your plot and not the other way around. But it does feel like they don't do a lot of comic books. I kind of feel like Red Hood and the Outlaws is kind of the closest I've come to writing X-Men, in the sense it's all really, really character driven, but on a bigger landscape, bigger canvas. But I look around and I just don't see a lot of comic books that, that do what the X-Men used to do, including the X-Men.
You're absolutely right. They are not as character driven. It's very much about plot. And I mean, I know Marvel after, what was it, Secret Empire, or was it Secret Wars, that, or after Secret Empire, they were on a like an 18-month no big event kind of mandate, so that way it wasn't, because it really was just going from one major line-wide crossover event to another major crossover event. And it's helped a bit, but at the same time, like, the X titles went back to, they were trying to kind of recapture that nostalgia and do a little bit more of that. Like, they, X-Men Gold would throw in a couple of, you know, the softball games and do those types of things. And it was fine. It's been okay. But the closest I think that they've come, in my opinion, has been X-Men Red, with the return of Jean Grey, bringing her back, the original Jean Grey, and her being on a mission and having this idea to kind of try to help, like, make the world a better place. And is they're introducing these characters in basically giving them each an issue. It's not just, okay, all of a sudden we have this team and this is what we're doing. They're trying to build it up, and you're seeing more of the character and who they are and why they are a part of this team that she's putting together. You know, so it's kind of a different take on it, and it feels more like an old school take on a storyline versus what they've been doing lately.
Well, I mean, it isn't like you talk about the publishers. It's an interesting question. Like, you know, you wonder how much is the publisher and how much is the editors and how much is the writers. You know, you get on a book and you're like, wow, you know, I'm writing, I finally get to write Captain America. I'm going to do my Red Skull story. And it's like, we've seen Red Skull. We know that someone's bothering Captain America, and at the end of the issue, a limousine is going to pull up, and the window's going to roll down. And oh my God, it's the Red Skull. You know, it's like, we've seen it. Let's see something else. And I think that, like, so I don't know if it's editors not pushing writers, writers not pushing ideas, writers not challenging themselves. I don't know what it is, but I hear that they're.
In terms of the X-Men, I'm hoping that now that Disney is reacquiring their film rights, as odd as it sounds, I think that may end up having a pot. They may put more emphasis on the X-Books again. But I feel like that, I don't want to say they were sabotaging themselves, but it felt like they pushed them to the back because they didn't have the film rights. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know, but I felt like everything after second, I still read the X-Men, and I felt like everything after Second Coming, which was a storyline from, I'm going to guess, like 2012, they really haven't been doing much with the characters, and they haven't really given them much of a consistent, creative team or writers. And because that feels like they're going in all different directions. It's like, oh, we'll give this writer the X-Men for a year and a half, and then we'll do a whole new creative team, you know, shortly after that. Maybe I'm rambling at this point, but but yeah. But yeah, I kind of feel like that a lot of the comics these days, they've been, especially at Marvel, they've been using them more or less as just marketing tools for the movies. So if a character in the movie, if a character is getting a movie, they decide to start emphasizing them in the comics, regardless of where the character was left off previously. And yeah, it's I feel like it takes away a little bit from the character development too.
I mean, the whole thing is kind of odd. You know, like when I was I remember being on a plane in 92, I think it was, and you know, this happened to me all the time. People be like, oh my god, you write the X-Men? I'm like, yeah. They go, oh, I love the X-Men. The X-Men is my favorite. It is amazing. Rogue and Storm, oh my god, I love them so much. And then they go, are you in charge of the voices? I go, well, I don't do the comic book. I mean, I don't do the Saturday morning show. I only do the comic book. And they go, there's a comic book too? You know, and that happened all the time. And so, like, you know, I was around for it. I saw the sales. There was no sales increase when the X-Men, you know, when the animated show was happening. You know, like, there was the only time I've ever seen a crossover, I think, was the very first Batman movie with Michael Keaton. I remember living in Yonkers, and they showed the movie, and everybody poured out of that movie and ran into the comic book store and just bought the crap out of anything Batman. But other than that, I mean, I don't think the X-Men, I don't think the Avengers sales go up because of the Avengers movies. And I don't think, you know, an Ant-Man book is going to sell because the Ant-Man movie came out, or Daredevil is going to increase because people are watching Netflix. So I don't, you know, like, I think it's great that there is source material to feed other venues, and that other venues are being more respectful of the source material. I think this notion that as an industry we're supposed to chase the movie or chase the TV show that's taking the comic book and adapting the stories, and it's like, you know, like a bad Tom and Jerry, you know, which is like running around. And I don't think I think we just need to get back to the idea of like just trying to write the best comics that we can, and hopefully come up with storylines that people want to knock off for the next 20 years. I mean, to your point, I think I would like to give people more credit, but I just think they just don't really seem to know.
I do want to touch on one major thing, especially because we are a gay and geeky podcast. We have to talk about it. North Star. Jake, it's all excited about this.
I haven't seen that, but you go ahead. I'll get to that. Well, I have a few questions.
Exactly. I figure I'll handle the North Star part. You can dig into the to the rest of it. So how did bringing North Star out as as a gay character. How did this come about, and how was this received? And like, it just the whole thing. How did this happen?
Well, it started because when I took over Alpha Flight, I wanted it down to 5 members, and you know, John Bergen always designed North Star. When he created North Star, he created him as a gay character, and if you look at his very first appearance, you know, he's by a pool and he has all these, you know, hot guys around him, and it's just him and a bunch of hot guys in the pool. And it was all very, you know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, because they couldn't come out and say he was gay, because at the time it just hadn't been done. And so when I took over the character, I looked at the character, and he was such a colossal dick. And I was like, why is this guy such a colossal dick? And I was thinking it's because if he was a big enough asshole, you wouldn't get to know him. And if you didn't get to know him, you wouldn't know who he really is. And so this was his defense mechanism. He just kept people away from him by projecting this idea of being this arrogant jerk. And I was like, you know, I want to get rid of that and see who he really is. And so I felt the way to do that was to have him stop hiding behind anything and just be himself and talk about who he was. And so at the time they were doing, at the time comic books always had inventory stories, which meant that you would write and draw and letter and color a story and have it all completely done, and it would be put in a drawer. And then if something happened, instead of nowadays where they're like misshipping, they would throw in this issue at the last second, you know. Or if, you know, an artist was, you know, artist wife was having a baby and he couldn't do it, and so, okay, we'll give him a break. Fortunately, we have the regular artist. We have this inventory story. So when it came time to do an inventory story for Alpha Flight, I said to the editor, this is my thinking about North Star, and I really want to just have him come out and talk about being gay. And her name is Bobby Chase, and she has a brother who's gay. And she was like, that sounds great. That sounds like a great story. It sounds like a story that needs to, you know, that's a good way to move the character forward. And so we put it in the drawer and didn't think anything of it. And then she went on to do Spirits of Vengeance as the group editor. And so she, before she went, she plugged in the North Star story. And we really didn't think anything of it. I believe Peter had touched on a gay AIDS related story in The Hulk with Jim Wilson or somebody. So it wasn't like it was that taboo a subject. Like writing it, I didn't think, oh my God, the whole world was going to lose their shit. But that's what happened. It came out and it was like, everybody just really got excited about it. And what was interesting to me is recently I did Teen Titans, where I had Bunker as this gay, openly gay Mexican teenager who never spent a minute of his life in the closet. He was just always who he was, and his family loved him and his village loved him, and that's who he was. And when he came out, there was all this press, and it felt very similar to what happened with North Star. And what I thought was, I'm not going to use the word sad, but what I thought was odd is I was thinking, you know what, like there's a 20 year gap between North Star and Bunker. And I'm thinking, you know what, I hope to God I'm alive in another 20 years so that if I introduce another gay character, that there are no headlines and there's no story and there's no hoopla. And it's just like, he's just another, you know, gay character in comic books, you know, it'd be, you know, that's, I hope where we get someday. But I will tell you recently, I was in a Paley Fest, which is where they have these people come out and, talk about their shows. And they were doing a reunion show for, Will and Grace. And I was sitting there in the audience, and they're like, you know, this show changed the future of all gayness in pop culture. Never before had this ever been done? And I think myself, like, I want to go, you're about like 5 years too late, because I had North Shore out way before anybody thought of putting on a show called Will and Grace. So, yeah. I mean, not that it was a great show. Just saying, you know, it's not like there had never been a gay anything until that show. Just saying.
That's actually one of the things that I always thought was really cool about comics, is that I always assumed that people who are TV and film execs paid attention to comics, because it seemed like whatever trend that was going to happen, it actually happened in comics first. And then like TV and film execs are like, okay, you know, maybe it is okay, we go in this direction. So, but yeah, you're right. There was I've seen LGBT characters popping up in comics long before TV and film. And that was one of the things that brought me into comics to begin with, was a representation that I wasn't seeing elsewhere. So and you know, definitely kudos for introducing North Star in that regard. I know that he was always meant to be gay, but you're the one that brought him out of the closet. Mm-hmm. One of the things I actually wanted to ask about, which I've heard this debated a lot online, but I've never heard anyone ask you about it, is the character of Iceman in recently in the X-Men comics he came out. I've heard people debate that you had kind of laid the groundwork for that. And I remember as a kid even reading it, even thinking that, oh my God, maybe he is making this character gay. Because there was like scenes where it seemed like there was some coded language, like especially after the White Queen, Emma Frost, had possessed Iceman's mind. She kind of taunted him with a couple things like, oh, your first love is interior decorating. And at one point she pulled up a mental image of Opal and she was having Opal say some things like, you never really loved me. And there was a lot of debate that maybe you were laying the groundwork for Iceman to come out at some points. Is that off?
I loved the idea that Bobby had this bigoted father that he loved, but who was a bigot. And his bigotry was not about bringing home an Asian girlfriend. His bigotry was specific to Bobby, the one thing Bobby couldn't change about himself, which was that he was a mutant. And, you know, we had been surrounded by, you know, when you're an X-Men and you're with other X-Men, you all have pretty much the same basic concept, which is, you know, I am me and I, you know, you accept me, I accept you, were all mutants. But this notion that this guy that Bobby loved the most, his father, could never step around the fact that his son was a mutant, I thought was really powerful. And as an analogy to being gay, I thought it was really powerful. And so I was always drawing parallels to that, because Bobby was really the only character that I knew that had a family member that was against him. I think it worked well, and I certainly pushed it as, you know, close to the line as I could. I mean, even that scene in the X-Men movie where it's like, well, could you just pretend not to be a mutant? You know, could you just for us? That, you know, came, you know, was lifted almost entirely from the comic book. And that's what I felt. And that's what I was doing with that character. The fact that they moved that from subtext to text, you know, was a decision on their part, and that's great. But, you know, so I could see why people would debate, and I could see why people would make arguments for either case. But I just know in my own heart, the idea was to use his status as a mutant to cover a lot of the same ground that, you know, gay people face within their own families. And so that was the rationale for that. So, you know, so yes, I certainly did push it, but it was never, if I had been on the book another 50 years, I would never have come up with the idea for young Jean Grey to come in the future. And
The way they did it was a little strange, I have to admit. But yeah, I was, okay, so that's very interesting, very cool. Thank you. Yeah, and in terms of your writing and a lot of social issues, I know it seems like there was always a lot of subtext going on, and there was some things that was kind of in the background, never directly commented on, but it was there. And the one other thing I was kind of curious about, I was a big fan of Generation X. And one of the things about Generation X that I thought was really cool, and I don't know if it was intentional, but it was a very diverse group of beings, different representation, different races, being the black girl. But the one thing I thought was really cool was all the stereotypes I heard it. Jubilee was the slacker, she was the Asian girl. M was the black girl. She had a husband, and she was very studious and very smart, and it was all kind of the reverse of what people had associated as stereotypes of both races. I didn't know if that was intentional or just something that was accidental.
You know, it's funny because I was on a panel recently, and it was a diversity in comics panel. And they said, well, what do you think about diversity in comics? Do you say? And I said, well, you know what? I'm glad somebody finally came up with a name for what I've been doing for 25 years. You know, like if you look, I mean, Generation X is a perfect example. It's like, you know, there had never been a team that was like at least either mostly women or, you know, it was always, you know, like, you know, Wonder Woman was like, you know, I'm sorry, Justice League Mirror was like six guys and a girl. And yeah, so the point is that, yeah, I did, I was very, very conscious when I was creating Generation X to make Generation X not a book that had previous, that looked like any previous book. You know, even like when Chris and I were designing characters, you know, we would say, oh, here's this character M, and, you know, she's sort of like this young black older woman type, you know, character. And they're like, okay, well, who's the Colossus of the group? Who's the Maul? Who's, you know, who's the Thor, you know, who's the big powerful guy? And I was like, you know, we don't really have that. We have Mondo, who's this big Samoan guy, big overweight Samoan guy with a Hawaiian shirt. And they're like, you know, they're like, okay, well, who's your Wolverine character? Who's your one that, he starts going to get like really mad and like, be, oh yeah, we don't have that either. So we really wanted to make the characters and make the book different from any of the previous books. And so that's what we worked really hard. And when it came out, I thought, wow, I told Chris, I said, wow, we have created the new template that everybody's going to rip off now. For years, everybody ripped off the X-Men, you know, Wildcats, Cyber Force, you know, all these books. Always, 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 let's go back to that X-Men template. And I said, we've created a template that people are going to steal till the end of time. And no one ever stole it. I remember when they were relaunching Legion of Superheroes, and they had this ad, 36 superheroes. Was over DC, and I go, I don't get it. It's like, this is like the most amazing superheroes in the universe. You have 36 characters, and you have one black person in the group. Like, you know, you can't do better than one black person. And they're like, well, you know, there's like a blue character, and there's your, I'm like, yeah, well, you know, on their planets, they're blue and green, but like, really, you're talking about, and I remember even when, first Mightiest Heroes, I'm sorry, when Avengers came back, and they're like, oh, Earth's Mightiest Heroes, they're back, Earth's Mightiest Heroes. And I went in, I go, Earth's Mightiest Heroes, you couldn't find one black mighty hero on the planet? Like, nobody? And they said, well, you know, we're introducing this character in issue 6, Triathlon or whatever his name is, Triad or something. But I'm like, yeah, but it's called Earth's Mightiest Heroes. You know, you can't find one black person to throw on your team with Earth's Mightiest Heroes. I don't know. It always bothered me. But what bothered me is that, you know, I'd be on panels, and, you know, long before what you guys, you know, podcasts are the big thing now, but, you know, in the old days, panels too were, panels were things that people really, was their way to talk to the people and have people talk back to them. now it seems every time I am on a panel, it's like, you know, somebody up there going, and this issue, click, and the slide shows up. Ooh, look at that cover. And they go, what's going to happen? And somebody goes, oh, I can't tell you what happens in that issue because it's a secret. What is that your issue about? I can't tell an issue either because it's a secret. And you're like, you know, but back then, panels were how people, you know, communicated. And what I would, I'd always be in the, I'd go to these conventions and look out and you'd see, you know, Black people and Asian people and gay people and, you know, everybody. And you think, okay, this is what comic books should look like. They should, it should be a reflection of the people and the world around them. So I was always very conscious of trying to do that.
So we've spent a lot of time talking about, obviously, the X-Men and now Gen X, because I think it's safe to say that's really kind of Jay's and I's wheelhouse and formed a lot of our who we are as people now. But I want to ask you, before we move off of comics and do a little touching on to movies, what has been your favorite comic to write, or even if it's just an individual character or a team, like what's been the one that you've really enjoyed the most?
Certainly the first 25 issues of Generation X were really special. Part of the reason they were special is because when somebody thinks they know the best way to do something, they'll offer their opinion on things a lot. And they'll say, you should do this and do that and don't do this and da da da. But if they don't do it, then they're more trusting of me to do what I'd like to do and kind of pursue it. And there are a lot of people in the X-Men office who, you know, the way things work, they have to be in charge of making the X-Men work the way it should work, and I get that. But Generation X was so such a totally different creature. And, you know, what Chris and I were able to do within the book, no one really understood it, so there weren't many notes. And so that was a lot of fun because it was like, you know, you just kind of, you know, Chris, one issue decided to throw in little elves in the story.
Yeah.
Just threw them in and he's like, here you go. And I'm like, okay. So I was like, and I'm looking at the thing, you know, I think I can write another story inside this story using these. So, you know, try doing that on the X-Men. They would have been like, whoa. So that was fun. And then also, you know, in the New 52, there was a lot of editorial pushback on a lot of things. They were kind of torn between this idea of like, okay, Scott, we want you to come in and reimagine things from scratch. And I said, okay. And then as the series progressed, they'd be like, well, you know, you need to bring in Trigon. I'm like, no one cares about Trigon. Trigon only has one setting. And that setting is, I want to take Earth and turn it into hell. And that's never going to happen. It's like Galactus. Galactus is, one thing is, I'm going to come down and eat the planet. And you're like, well, okay, we know that's not going to happen. You know, so what do you do? It always comes down to how Reed's going to stop him. And so, but with Rebirth, there's been a lot more freedom. And I think that people who read Red Hood now will see that there's a lot more of freedom in the storytelling, which is when I'm having my most fun. But having said that, I do like when, I didn't mind when I was writing the X-Men, not only did I not mind, I enjoyed the challenge of being part of something bigger. I will tell you a fun story about Onslaught. Have you guys ever heard the Onslaught story?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
About the origin of it or no?
I mean, I know the story. I don't know the writing.
Well, this is kind of a fun thing. What happened was, after the Age of Apocalypse, we were in a conference room and all sitting around, and we said, if you could do one story, what would you want to do? Because we were all so tied in tightly with Age of Apocalypse. And, you know, Warren Ellis is like, I'd like to do a scene where they all go to the pub and they all get pissed, but I know you won't let me do it. And it's like, okay, well, that sounds like a great idea. You should do that. I'm like, oh. And me, if you could do any story, what story would you do? And I go, I want to do a story where the X-Men are sitting at home and all of a sudden they hear this like, they run out to the front yard and bam, something hits the ground and skids for like a mile and slams into a tree. And they all run up to the tree and they all go, you know, and they look and the smoke settles and it's Juggernaut. He's just lying there and he's all bloody. And they're like, what happened? What happened? And he just says, Onslaught. Passes out. And they're like, wow. So who's Onslaught? I go, I have no idea, but I just think it would be so cool. That's the story I want to. And they're like, oh, yeah, but who is he? I go, I know, but he's got to be somebody. He beat up Juggernaut. That's awesome, right? And they're like, yeah, okay. So they let me do that story. So the next month, the issue comes out, and this editor approached Bob and said, hey, listen, you can't have Juggernaut get beat up and not explain how he got beat up. So Bob comes to me and he goes, we have to explain who Onslaught is. I go, I don't know who Onslaught is. And they go, he's like, yeah, but you need to explain it. I go, I have no interest in knowing who Onslaught is. So they just like that it happened. That's all. So he's like, okay. You know, sometimes we argue. Sometimes he's like, okay, whatever, Scott. So 6 months, 7 months go by, and there's a, they decide they're doing Heroes Reborn. And they have to, they need a character that's strong enough that can create this like pocket universe for all the other superheroes. But, we're going through the list. Like, well, that's not Doctor Doom. It's not Apocalypse. We just used Apocalypse like less than a year ago. We don't got anybody that can do it. And then one day I was at home. I'm like, oh, and I called up. I'm like, Onslaught can do it. I mean, he beat up Juggernaut, right? He should be able to create a pocket dimension. And Bob's like, okay, well, that's fine. Okay, but who is Onslaught? I don't know. So we were thinking, all right, it has to be somebody that was strong enough that could, you know, imagine this pocket universe, but would also want to keep the X-Men in place and send everybody else back. And we're like, could Professor X do that? No, but, you know, and Magneto can't do it. But what if it was Magneto and Xavier together? And it's like, okay, well, that's great, but why would they work together? And then it was like, what if when Xavier shut down Magneto's mind and he was great, he didn't shut down his mind. He pulled his mind into Xavier's mind. And so Magneto's been in there, like, corrupting Xavier's mind the whole time. And it's like, okay, all right, so this is Onslaught. Onslaught is an amalgamation of two of them. And then the fun part is, you go back 6 months in time, if you're Onslaught and you have this power to punish your enemies, and your enemy is somebody who tormented Charles Xavier when he was a kid, who's he going to go after first? Juggernaut. So it was like Hansel and Gretel, like following the breadcrumbs. You know, it was like, now you look at it and you go, oh yeah, Onslaught, everybody knows, yeah, when Onslaught showed up, he beat up Juggernaut because that's where, but there was no Onslaught until there was a need for Onslaught. And those things like that, I enjoy like when somebody goes, well, this needs to be done, how can we do it? And so that's the untold story of Onslaught.
That's really awesome.
Well, in terms of the Onslaught storyline you were talking about, it ended up tying into one of the first big mysteries that you introduced in your series, which was the X-Traitor. Did you ever have a different ending or different character in mind for the whole X-Traitor? Or was that something you were just kind of developing in your mind as the series went on?
Well, I scripted that issue with the first sentence of the X-Traitor in it, And it went, and so part of that had to do with hiding the identity. I'll tell you, I didn't like the resolution to the traitor storyline. I don't even think I wrote it. I think Mark Waid wrote it in that brief time he was there. But I'm okay with mysteries, so I would have been okay with not knowing who the traitor was for a few more years. But everybody, you know, nowadays it's so crazy. It's like, you know, you try to write a story, and like I had I did an issue recently where it opens up where somebody is tracking the main hero. And it's like the first two pages, like you see that he's being tracked. And in my head, it was going to be resolved in about four issues time. And it was like, oh, no. I get this all the time. Not to throw Rob under the bus because, you know, we worked it out, but, for years, anytime I'd introduce a subplot, they'd go, oh, no, you got it. What is this? You got to explain who it is and why he wants and what he's going to do. I'm like, in this issue? Yes. Readers don't like it. Readers don't like mystery. Okay. You know, like when you look at, you know, when you look at, Jean Grey coming out of the water and saying, I'm, you know, the lightness and the darkness or whatever, you know, that took 36 issues to play out, the death of Phoenix, you know. And when we first saw the car lights go by and we saw Jason Wingard and we saw the silhouette of Mastermind behind him, you know, that was, you know, and then suddenly, if I remember correctly, they, you know, went off into the savage land. They did all this stuff. But the thing is like these things happen and they build. Now, do I believe for an instant that Chris's idea was that Jean Grey was going to get seduced by Jason Wingard and the Hellfire Club, and that that would in turn break her down so that Dark Phoenix could happen? Nope, I do not believe it at all. If he ever told me that was the case, I would say, wow. but the thing is, these things, like, you know, you find things, you go, oh, well, that's really interesting, and da-da-da. You know, the first time John Byrne draws the Hellfire Club, and you're like, whoa, this is something we've never seen before. So all these things happen, and but at the time, like, that's, you know, subplots, I think, are awesome. I would carry a subplot for years and years. And, so I don't think that was the best solution.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was Onslaught. It was Professor X, but it was as Onslaught, not as Professor X.
Okay.
Yeah, the whole scene was, we saw in your first issue, we saw the scene from Jean Grey's perspective where it was broken apart, and then we saw the whole thing actually in the first part of the actual Onslaught storyline.
Yeah, okay, I remember. Yeah, you know, it's funny because we had a big argument, big argument. And, you know, Mark wanted to use Xavier's crush on, which happened in X-Men 3. Xavier had a crush on Jean Grey.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And, you know.
People had thoughts on that.
What's that?
People had a lot of thoughts on that. I remember people talking about that for a long time.
I know, and I was so adamant about not ever bringing it up again. I said, look, you know, and they would say, like, I said, you know, Professor X being a pedophile is not a storyline that, and Mark would go, he's not a pedophile. He suppressed his feeling of being a pedophile. Okay. And this went on and on and on, and I guess I lost that fight, but, you know, maybe I was checking out at that time, but, you know, like, to me, it was like, I would argue, I'd say, look, Stan, this is when I was on the phone, we used to have landline, threw that in there, realized it was a horrible idea immediately after he did it. It was never, ever, ever, ever referenced again. And I think it's, you know, maybe this has to do, and again, no, I don't mean this as a slight to these guys, to like the Waids and Busicks of the world who know every single thing that happened to every character in the Dawn of Time. Like, you know, maybe there is a storyline to go back to X-Men 3, you know, from 40 years before and go, oh, here's a story we didn't tell. But, you know, I'd rather tell stories that we want to tell, not stories we haven't told.
So, Scott, outside of comic books, one of the things that people may recognize your name from in more recent memory is the slasher film Happy Death Day. So can you tell us a little bit about how it was writing that and coming up with that story?
Sure. I'll tell you the thing that I liked most about writing Happy Death Day, and I was writing it I was living in Malibu at the time, and I met with a producer, and I told her, I said, yeah, I want to do the story. And she goes, well, that's great. You should write that story. And I'm like, okay. And I was done with comic book work, so I went and I turned off my phone and I wrote it over the course of 4 weeks. And what was funny was, as I was writing it, I was laughing to myself because I'm like, this is the most subversive horror movie ever, because people are going to show up thinking they're going to see a slasher flick, and instead they're going to see this story about a girl who is a jerk who eventually becomes somebody that you're rooting for, you know? Like, when I first wanted to do it, I was thinking, there's a bunch of horror movies out at the time, and I was like, I should write a horror movie, but if I have to write one, I want to write one like nobody else is doing. And I said, you know, in most horror movies, the bad girl gets killed right up front, and then the good girl is running around in her underwear in the last scene, and she lives. And I was like, is there a way to make the bad girl live to the end? Like, what if she starts out as the bad girl, but because she's dying, I guess, well, that doesn't make sense. She can't die. And I'm like, well, what if she dies and she relives it? And so she becomes a good. So it wasn't like I was like, sat down going, I'm going to do, Groundhog's Day as a slasher movie. It was like, this is what I want to do with the movie. How do I do it? And then I was like, oh, I can use the Groundhog template. And what I felt was really, to me, in writing it was the, one of the things that I enjoyed was, after the movie was over and we were talking about, an aspect of the movie, and I was talking to somebody, and he said, well, you know, as far as credit goes, you have to be careful because, like, you know, you really just took Groundhog's Day and turned it into a slasher movie. And I said, I think I really did. I said, to me, part of the fun of the movie was the fact that there was a murder mystery. You know, if anything, it was a lot more like this old movie called DOA, which I don't know if you know DOA. It opens with a old black and white movie. A guy walks into a police station, it's raining, and he walks up to the front desk. He's like, I'd like to report a murder. And they're like, ooh. And he goes, me. And what you find out is that he was poisoned, and now he has like 24 hours to figure out who killed him. And to me, part of the fun of Happy Death Day was it wasn't just the resetting of the day, like in Groundhog's Day. And, you know, we've seen Tom Cruise's movie. We've seen, you know, a bunch of other things. We saw an episode of X-Files where they were at a bank and it kept reliving the day and Scully kept getting shot. But what we hadn't seen was a murder mystery, was like, you know, to end the day in such a way that we don't know who it is that's killing her, and that there'd be a bunch of suspects, you know. I mean, that I thought that was really, really made it fun and different. So as I was writing it, I was thinking, you know, people are going to show up because they want to see some girl get tracked by a killer, but it turns out that it's, you know, it's really the story about, it's really Tree's story, which I thought was, like I say, very subversive.
Absolutely. Now, how long did it take from the time that you wrote the story till it was able to be brought to life on the screen?
10 years. 10 years almost to the day.
And so how did that come about for Blumhouse to want to bring this? Did they approach you? Did you approach them?
Oh, no, it had been in, first it was at Universal Rogue Pictures, which I don't think exists anymore. And that was there for 2 years. And then it was somewhere else. And then it had become a, it almost became a streaming thing. They were going to spend $135,000 on it. And fortunately, that wasn't made. And then Netflix was going to do it. And then that fell apart. And then Chris, who had been attached, he'd done a draft of the script years ago when it was just about to go. And he wound up, by that point, Chris had done like 4 movies with Blumhouse. So he was out to lunch with that same producer who got me to write it. And he said, where's that movie stand? And she said, oh, you know, it's right now the rights are up in the air. And so he was like, holy moly. So he left that lunch on a Friday and called Jason and said, I have the story. And by Monday, Jason was like, here's $5 million, go do this movie. And so that was it. So it went from like, you know, as is often, I mean, like, you know, you always hear about things like, Sopranos that got rejected by 16 studios. And then on the 17th studio, they're like, ah, all right, we'll make this. And then, you know, TV history changes. So, it was really not uncommon for a movie to take a long time to sit in different, you know, different venues. But so that was Happy Death Day's gestation period.
So now, okay, so you write this story. 10 years later, it gets made into a film. How did you, like, how much control, how much say did you have in seeing the adaptation go from... The listeners can't see that, but a big old zero. So, okay. So that's actually... I'm actually almost even happier that that's the answer. What did you think of it?
Well, I tell people all the time that the very first thing they do in Hollywood, when you sell a movie, the very first thing they do is fire the writer. But it's true. I've, you know, sold 7 movies and 6 TV pilots over the years, and the first thing they do is they just fire the writer. I wrote a movie with my best friend John. We wrote a movie called Man of the House with Tommy Lee Jones, and we were rewriting it, and we got to page 52. They brought in a director. He had his ideas. We got to page 52 and they fired us. And then, I was at Hollywood Cemetery about, I don't know, 10 years later. And somebody goes, he was a writer and he said, what are you doing? I said, I wrote a movie called, Man in the House with Tommy Lee Jones. He goes, I gotta tell you guys, I felt terrible. He said, I was in a meeting with the producer. And the producer said, hold on a second, I got to make this call. And I'm sitting there, and she gets on the phone, and she goes, yeah, we have the writers, and they're working on a draft, but we want you to write the movie. So as soon as this draft is done, we're going to have you start it. And he goes, I just can't imagine what that's like to be like, sitting there working on a rewrite, knowing that they've already gotten rid of you. And I said, you know what, it's just the nature of the piece. You know, it's not anything to take personally, you know, so, but like this movie that I'm doing now, that won't be the case, you know, and even Chris Landon's very first movie, Disturbia. You know, he wrote the script, but then by the time the script got to production, I mean, they, you know, fired him pretty much immediately. It's just what they do. You guys saw the movie. There's, in the original movie, there were 2 characters, Brett and Carter. And Brett was this guy who had slept with Tree, and she couldn't remember because she slept with so many people that she was like, he's like, you don't remember, you in bed? And she's like, yeah, she's in bed with a lot of people. And then there was, when she realized she was caught in this time loop, she went to a character called Carter, who she realized kept spilling chocolate milk on her every day. And realized that, okay, wait a minute, that wasn't an accident. This was him trying to talk to her. And he was so awkward. He was like, oh, this will be a way that I can meet her. And so he was this comic book geek who actually referenced Uncanny 134, the Days of Future Past issue.
Oh, yeah.
And to, you know, get her to realize, Hockey even said, here, you got to go read this. And so it was decided that, in fact, later on in the movie, when she's about to be killed by Toombs, who oddly enough was, I named after my high school gym teacher. he was, she was about to be killed, and up until this point, she thought Brett was a suspect until Brett saved her from getting killed. So like that, all that was there, but when Chris came on, he was like, I think it's better if it's one character. Carter is the love interest throughout, instead of having Carter as the geek and Brett as the love interest. And so, you know, that was decided, but you know, that is it something that I would have done eventually because the network said, or because the studio was like, oh, do this. I might have, you know, or I might not have, but so that's what happened. So you're looking, you know, the way I see, movies or, you know, I've done TV pilots, I've done movies, and even sometimes in comic books, is the way I see it is you, have a kid and you raise the kid and you tell the kid not to, smoke and swear and have premarital sex, and you love your child, and then your child goes off to college and they come back and they're smoking and they're pregnant and they're cussing up a storm, but it's still your kid and you're going to love it. And so that's how I feel about Happy Death Day. You know, there are changes from the original script, but that is what happens when, you know, you hire a director and, you know, you hire characters and cast, and before you know it, it's its own creature. And, but at the end of the day, it's still a guy sitting down at a computer in Malibu and closing the door and turning off his phone. And that's how movies are made.
Fantastic. Now, you've mentioned a couple things that you're working on. What's the next big thing that you are super excited about that you want our listeners to be on the lookout and to check out?
Well, certainly, you know, Red Hood and the Outlaws 25 got the best reviews in my career, but that might be because, too, there weren't really reviews back in the X-Men days. I'd like to think they would have been pretty good. I'm really, really excited about where things are going with Red Hood. So that's exciting. I have a big meeting on Wednesday that, when it happens, will probably keep me busy for the next 10 years in movies. So that'll be very exciting. I'm pitching a trilogy, and I'm very excited about it. And if it, I will promise you that, I mean, the studio will have to announce it first, but once the studio announces it, I promise you that we'll get back on here and you'll be the exclusive podcast of this announcement. So, how's that?
That's awesome. Looking forward to that.
So, yeah, I mean, the thing about this town is, as you saw with the 10 years of Happy Death Day in the making, is I always call it, it's the town of hurry up and wait. You know, we need this on Thursday. We need you to turn in this script on Thursday, or everything's going to go south. And then you turn the script in on Thursday, and it's like, you know, a year later, we read the script and we have some notes. The town of hurry up and wait. So
where can our listeners keep up with the goings on of Scott Lobdell?
You're the answer of that, Patrick, because you know that you're on Facebook and you reviewed my movie and I swooped in. So Scott Lobdell could be virtually anywhere at any moment on your Instagram feed, on your Facebook feed. You know what's funny is there's a guy who, there's a writer who, I don't know his name, but I was at a DC conference, and this guy said, the very famous writer every year, he writes a manifesto about the state of writing in the industry. And 5 years ago, he said, if you're a writer you have to get out there and get your face out there, and you have to get on Instagram, you have to get on Facebook, and you have to like really connect with people. And that's the way to build your career and your following and your readership. And that's what you have to do. And then here it was, that was 5 years ago. Then 5 years later, he said, the guy wrote a manifesto and he said, you know what? Get offline, get off Instagram, get off Twitter and just write. That's your job. You're a writer. You should be writing. And I, you know, like if you follow my Instagram, it's the most innocuous, silly stuff because it's, you know, I'm not promoting my work. I did kind of push. I pushed Happy Death Day, but I tried to do it the most ridiculous way possible. Like I had a picture of my serial killer sneaking up on Thor. And it was like, oh, Thor's coming out this weekend, but I'm telling you, Happy Death Day is going to crush him. You know, not going to happen. And then the next, that Monday, I had a I had a Thor hammer just smashing the mask. I'm like, okay, I was off by $50 million, but the point is, do silly things like that because they amuse me. But you know, for the most part, I don't. You know, like you know, I don't know if Scott Snyder will listen to this. I don't mean this in as a slight against Scott, but you know, like if you look at my Instagram, there's you know, I don't know, 4,000 people. I don't know. And you look at Scott's, and I don't know, there's 60,000. But there's not a, I know you guys can do the math. I don't know what the difference between 4,000 and 60 is, but let's say it's, you know, 500 times or something. But that doesn't mean that the readership for Batman is 500 times the readership of Red Hood and the Outlaws. So I don't really know, you know, when you really, really look at it, I don't know what having, 15,000 or 100,000 or, you know, and there's this guy, Donald Trump, who used to do real estate and he has millions of followers now on Twitter, I think it is. But it's not like that. Those millions of followers, translate into popularity.
You know? I actually have this discussion with a lot of people, and it's sometimes you follow someone just because you need to know what they're saying doesn't mean they're popular or well liked. I actually hate Donald Trump, and I follow him just so I know what he's saying. So when my family tries to defend him or tries to praise him, I know exactly what they're talking about. I always tell people it's important to follow certain people just so you know what they're saying and you know how to retort, basically come back at them.
And like, you know, yeah, you know, I could see Scott. I mean, Scott is you know, I follow his feed. He's a great guy, but like, you know, this notion of and I shouldn't say it as if that's why he's doing it. I'm not saying that he has all these followers because he's doing that. I'm just saying that, like, you know, I don't I've come to the conclusion that I'd rather just, you know, write and, you know, not have a scottlovebell.com, not have a you know, anything more than that. So to answer your question in the most roundabout way possible, you know, I don't really have a lot of, ways to follow me other than, you know, Bleeding Cool seems to have this love-hate relationship with me where they are either making fun of me or patting me on the head. I do that with everybody again.
I'll say it depends on who's writing the article.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I just I mean, look, you saw Happy Death Day and you didn't know I did it until you saw my name in the credits.
Yeah, and actually, and as soon as you started talking about the way you kind of tongue-in-cheek were promoting it, I was like, okay, no, I remember that, and I every time it would pop up on my Facebook feed, I absolutely loved it. It was like, you know, just having the serial killer like just randomly behind different things. I was like, this is 100% like the way that things should be done.
Yeah, like on Thanksgiving, I put the serial killer's knife from the billboard where you saw the knife and you saw his face in the thing.
Uh-huh.
And I have him stabbing a turkey.
I love it.
That's at Scotty Bobdella Instagram. So if you are listening to this podcast and you haven't seen it and you want to follow, you can follow it, but just don't expect anything of any merit.
Well, it has been fantastic. Thank you again so much for taking time to sit and chat with us. It's been amazing. Jay, thank you for joining me on this this interview episode. And
no, it's been a big pleasure. Thank you for having me. It's amazing I got to actually talk to Scott Lobdell.
Jay, listen to me. If he tries to do the follow-up podcast on the big announcement and he's like, yeah, Jay doesn't really bring a lot, I'll be like, no. I'll be like, I will not go on without Jay and Ronan.
Perfect. And well, Ronan, you there.
Well, I'll
try to get him here.
I was going to say, I might not have Jay on, but I'll definitely have Ronan.
Right?
Scott Lobdell, thank you so much one more time. It's been a fantastic pleasure to chat with you.
Imagine what it was like for me. I got to meet both of you. You only got to meet one of me. So I had twice the fun that you guys had.
Well, thank you so much. We look forward to seeing what this new secret project is going to be. And we look forward to having you back on once that is announced and get to talk to you some more. So thank you so much, listeners. This has been fantastic. I'm just speechless on how amazing this has been. Hope that you've enjoyed this interview. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode. Make sure that you go and check us out at flameonshow.com. Follow us on the social medias. If you are enjoying this and you want to become a patron subscriber, make sure you go check out Nerdy Show's Patreon at patreon.com/nerdyshow. Become a patron. You can even earmark some of those dollars to come straight to us. And that does it for us. Jay, thank you one more time for being on this.
It's amazing.
And Scott Lobdell, thank you again. And we look forward to chatting with you more.